This week on Making Contact.
The Occupy movement is already victorious because it has shattered sleepwalking. Everybody's got to talk about corporate greed.
With a world in transition and the future so unclear, what kind of promises can we make to our children? What can we do to ensure a just world for them? And what are the youth doing now to make it happen for themselves?
What is it that people who see the need for revolution need to be doing right now? Fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution is a big part of the answer.
On this edition, a dialogue between Princeton University professor Cornel West and Revolutionary Communist Party USA spokesman Carl Dix about the future of America's youth in the age of Obama. I'm Kyungjin Lee, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. For many Americans, communism is still treated as a dirty word, a remnant of the Red Scare of the 1950s. But between the financial crisis and the Occupy movement, the current capitalist system is increasingly being questioned. And the Communist Party, which had a strong presence in the U.S. through the first half of the 20th century, is trying to be more relevant. It's unlikely they'll be competing for major elected offices anytime soon. But as the greed enabled by a crony capitalist system becomes more apparent, the ideas of a more communal society are gaining credence. Carl Dix is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA. On December 2, 2011, he and Cornel West spoke in front of almost 2,000 people at the University of California at Berkeley. Dix focused his speech on the detrimental effects of police abuse and mass incarceration, and what a possible solution might look like for young people today.
This movement that's spreading, this Occupy movement, points to the potential to bring forward and seize a different future for our youth. Because the future that this system offers our youth comes down to nothing better than being functionaries serving a global empire that is raining death and destruction on the planet. But we can and must seize a different future. Now, to seize this potential, we got to address questions like, what is it that we're up against? I mean, and we could just get a globe up here and spin it and come down to the U.S., the so-called best of all possible societies. We could look at gay people being demonized by right-wing politicians and preachers, being bullied, being beaten, and even killed, all for no other reason than that they dare to have intimate relations with someone of the same sex. We could look at immigrants, people who have come to this country in search of work and survival, but who find here Nazi-like laws that drive them to the margins of society, and La Migra raids that separate families and disappear people. And we would also find the brutal oppression that black people have faced from the time when the very first African was dragged to these shores in slavery chains. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. First off, I want to read a quote from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, called Three Strikes. It gives us a historical perspective on this. The book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, has shined a bright and much needed light on the reality of profound injustice at the very core of this country. And this brings me to a very basic point. This system in this country, in the whole history of its treatment of black people, what has it been? First slavery, then Jim Crow, segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror, and now the new Jim Crow. Police brutality and murder, wholesale criminalization and mass incarceration, and legalized discrimination yet again. Now I want to focus on and talk a little bit about that last part that he talked about, the new Jim Crow. But I want to get at what's behind that, what creates the situation out of which that came. This is about conscious policies of the ruling class. Well, what are those policies? We could talk about stop and frisk, an official policy of the New York Police Department and police departments in a few other cities This policy empowers the police to stop, demand identification from, and to search people for any reason or no reason at all. And in New York, they are on track, on a pace right now, to stop 700,000 people this year under stop and frisk. 5 out of 6 of the people they stop are Black or Latino, and more than 90% of them were doing nothing wrong when the cops stepped to them and subjected them to harassment and humiliation and maybe a beatdown and arrest and maybe even stole their life. We also could talk about just the way that discrimination against Blacks and Latinos is rife in the criminal justice system. The Sentencing Project did a nationwide study of the racial composition of people involved in drug cases. And here's what they found. They found that more than 60% of the people who get arrested for possession of illegal drugs are white. But then they tracked those cases as they went through the criminal justice system, and they found that when you got to who ended up in prison, 75% of the people who end up in prison for drug possession are Black or Latino. We just talking drug possession here. We're not talking about, you know, other crimes of violence. And drug possession is almost half of the 2.4 million people who are in jail in this country. And less than 25% of the people who go to jail for drugs are white. So you start out with a majority white, but then you end up with a majority Black or Latino. And the way you end up there is the discrimination that operates within the criminal justice system. And this is how you end up with racially targeted mass incarceration. But then we also got to talk about how people are treated when they're in prison. And they're treated like less than human beings. They're fed food that's barely edible, subjected to arbitrary authority by the guards. Then you have the people who are in the segregation units, what California calls special housing units. These people are held in conditions that fit the international legal definition of torture. Because if you're held in one of those special housing units or SHUs, you are in conditions where you're denied human contact for days, weeks, sometimes months at a time. See, and I'm not just saying you don't get to have your phone call or visit from your families or your lawyer or something like that. They got it set up so you don't even see the person who brings you the food every day. You don't have contact with any other human being. And international law has defined that as torture and banned it for being employed against people who are in prison. But there are tens of thousands of people in prison in this country who are being treated exactly like that. See, and it's conditions like that that sparked the 2 hunger strikes that prisoners here in California in these special housing units waged over this summer. See, yeah, you gotta give it up for that. Then we have to put on top of this the way people get treated when they're released from prison after they've served their sentences. What does that come down to? You get discriminated against when you go looking for employment. They got a box you got to check that you've been in jail. And checking that box usually means you don't get the job. And if you try to get by and don't check the box and they found out that you have been in jail, that's grounds for firing you. You're denied access to public housing. They don't even let you vote. Now, when you put all of that together and link that to the overall discrimination that Blacks and Latinos face in this society, it adds up to me like a picture of a slow genocide. And then when you figure the way things are going in this country and the way in which they're whipping up people to get behind even more stringent and vicious forms of punishment, I mean, I'm sure a lot of y'all saw that Republican debate where the moderator happened to mention that Governor Perry from Texas had presided over 134 executions, and the audience interrupted the thing by cheering. Well, people who are going to cheer when they hear that somebody has executed 134 human beings are people who would form a social base for even worse crimes and atrocities carried out against people. And my point in bringing this up is that slow genocide that I talked about could easily become a fast one. See, so this is what we're up against, and what it comes down to is that there ain't no way you're going to deal with this short of making revolution and getting rid of this system once and for all. That's what it comes down to, sisters and brothers. That's what we're up against, and that's the way we got to move on it. Now, when I say this, I know that for some people, it's like, did I hear that right? Is that man up there talking about communist revolution and saying it's a good thing? Well, yes, I am. And look, and before you say, he must be crazy, doesn't he know that communism failed? Well, I would ask you to do this. Consider what's the source of that conventional wisdom that communism has failed, and that it's the same people who don't tell you the truth about history, about the current state of society here in this country and around the world, and don't tell you about how it got that way. Those are the people who are telling you communism has failed. Now, what is it that people who see the need for revolution need to be doing right now? Fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution is a big part of the answer. Now, what this means is building resistance in a way that enables people to raise their heads, to get a better sense of what they're up against, who the enemy is, but also who their potential friends and allies are, and what kind of struggle needs to be waged in order to win. See, and this also has a lot of implications today in the midst of Occupy Everywhere spreading across the country. Because you saw in this people standing up and resisting some of the economic deprivation that is being brought down on the great majority of people here. But as it developed, you also saw people connecting with other struggles. There was a conference in Arizona where some reactionary forces were getting together to plot even further attacks on the immigration movement. And what the Occupy forces in Arizona did is they laid siege to this conference. You know, and the police were there trying to defend these people, trying to come up with more cruel ways to come at immigrants. But the Occupy people were like, we ain't stepping back, because this is part of what we got to deal with. People seeing links between the different struggles, connecting the dots, as some people have said. This is an important part of what you can accomplish through fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. Thank you, sisters and brothers.
You've been listening to Carl Dix, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, speaking in December 2011 at the University of California at Berkeley. We'll be right back with Professor Cornel West after a break. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Up next, Princeton University professor Cornel West talks about America's indifference in addressing the needs of the poor over the past 30 years, and how the Occupy movement has started empowering young people to change the course of history.
I want to thank my dear brother Carl Dix. A lot of people ask me, Brother West, why you spend so much time with revolutionary communists and revolutionary anarchists and prophetic Jews and prophetic Buddhists and prophetic Hindus and all those agnostics and atheists. You know you nothing but a funky Holy Ghost Black Baptist, brother. I said, yes, I'm a Jesus-loving free black man. And I come from a tradition that says lift every voice. And if you have the courage to accent truth, you're going to have to listen to every voice, because no individual, no group has a monopoly on truth. We need to listen to one another and learn from one another if we're going to organize and mobilize together. I'll work with prophetic Mormons if they want to talk about corporate greed and wealth inequality and
The role of big money in politics and arbitrary military power and arbitrary police power, it has to do with what kind of human being you really are. What are you willing to sacrifice for? So if you're committed to truth, and the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak, and if you're concerned about justice, and justice is what love looks like in public. So if you love poor people, if you love Jamal on the chocolate side of town, if you love Juanita on the Latino side of town, or Harry on the vanilla side of town, or on the Asian side of town, then you won't talk about justice, because when you love folk, you can't stand the fact they're being treated unjustly. If you have the courage to allow suffering to speak, and you're concerned about the sources of social misery, and you see the connection between unjust social structures and unfair structures of domination generating unnecessary social misery, then you're already on the love train. Oh, yes. We need the OJs, don't we? And that's my tradition. John Coltrane's a love supreme. It's Curtis Mayfield. It's Aretha Franklin. There's a genius born just down the road named Sly Stone in Vallejo. What did he say? Stand. You've been sitting much too long. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. Stand. They'll try to make you crawl because they know what you're saying makes sense and all. Stand, there's a midget standing tall, and the giant beside him about to fall. Stand, there's a cross for you to bear, things to go through if you're going anywhere. Those are not just words to titillate and stimulate. Too many of our young folk are tied into this culture of superficial spectacle where they're told to be human is to be titillated and stimulated. So they become addicted and self-medicated to keep them sleepwalking. No, the Occupy movement is about the awakening. It's about those Sly Stone call everyday people. Or those the late Jake James Cleveland call ordinary people. If you're fundamentally committed to the preciousness and the pricelessness of ordinary people and everyday people, I don't care what color, I don't care what culture, what civilization, what sexual orientation, it's a human thing. And the problem has been in the last 30 years that the framework for those who love poor people and love working people has been pushed to the side. This ice age we have been living in where it's fashionable to be indifferent to poor people. That's why our children, can you imagine? 42% of our precious children of all colors live in or near poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. That's moral obscenity. Every American ought to be ashamed. And it's tied to greed, especially corporate greed at the top. So we need to talk about oligarchic power, plutocratic power, billions of dollars at the top, trillions given to those at the top because they too big to fail. As if our precious young people are too little to be highlighted. I don't know about you, I'm tired of that hypocrisy. Investment bankers get in trouble, call for welfare and get trillions of dollars, and our poor brothers and sisters call for help and they're told to be responsible and deal with the consequences of your actions. The poor brother on the corner gets caught with a crack bag and goes to jail for 7 years, but those on Wall Street involved in criminal behavior, insider trading, market manipulation, predatory lending, not one has been investigated or prosecuted. That's arbitrary rule of law. You can't have a society that holds together if you don't come to terms with arbitrary rule of law. So, Brother West, what are you calling for? Well, one, let me say this, that I am excited about the Occupy movement. And why am I excited? Because it's led by young people. More of them know Lupe Fiasco than they do Donny Hathaway. You need to know both. They know Erykah Badu more than Nina Simone. They need to know both. Have a sense of history even as you make history in the present.
And it's a beautiful thing for an old school brother like me to see young people disproportionately straighten up their backs and standing the way Sly Stone said, standing that poetic way of exercising your imagination and your empathy. And you're saying, like my dear brother Carl Dix, we refuse to accept the notion that there's no alternative to the present. We will not defer to the truncated public discourse that says the only limits of our politics is a choice between a mean-spirited, mediocre, mendacious Republican Party and a milquetoast and spineless Democratic Party. We refuse to confine ourselves to that kind of limit. We want something else. We want a better world. We want more imagination. We want more empathy. And they say, oh, that's just utopian. You're just dreaming. What's wrong with dreaming? And by dreaming, I'm not talking about some kind of cheap utopianism. I'm talking about how you generate hope. And again, I come from a people, black folk, where for so long, the hope was a crime. Can you imagine what it's like? 244 years of slavery for the very notion of dreaming end up executed. Later on under Jim Crow, swinging from a tree. Or even in the 1960s, when you really dream like Martin, the FBI keeps track of you every day from January 1956 until your day you die, and you discover that the very photographer with you every day was an FBI informant. Dream or die. And it has to do with the depths of your love. If you're willing to love, you can't help but dream alternative visions to a nightmarish present. And may be confined solely to your side of town, but you're like the canary, sooner or later, it's gonna hit vanilla suburbs too. The Occupy movement now is in a stage where it's getting blues-like because the attacks are becoming more vicious, the lies are becoming thicker. You're gonna have to learn something from a blues people. You're going to have to learn how to preserve hope and give up your cheap optimism. Hope and optimism qualitatively different. It's going to have something to do with the depths of your commitment. It's going to have something to do with the very young people that Brother Carl Dix was talking about, the ones locked into the military-industrial complex. We've spent $300 billion in the last 28 years. Called a Marshall Plan, but it's a penal carceral Marshall Plan. They told us they didn't have a Marshall Plan for education, didn't have a Marshall Plan for housing, didn't have a Marshall Plan for jobs with decent wage, but they found $300 billion for a carceral penal Marshall Plan for jails, prisons, and the criminal justice system. But we got to connect that prison industrial context with the military industrial complex, because the military budget also is a major priority. We have no money, but here comes Iraq. We have no money, but here comes Afghanistan. Always find the money there. Not for the children, not for the workers, not for the poor. Warped priorities. Then we connect it to the corporate oligarchic complex on Wall Street and corporate elites, where the wealth is hemorrhaged at the top. 1% of the population owning 40% of the wealth. The top 400 individuals in America have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million. Now that for me is a key sweat moment. Something just ain't right. And I keep pointing out to artists because you have to play, artists must play a fundamental role in this movement. Because when you talk about what we're up against, you better have your spirit fortified. You better have your soul so determined that nothing can turn you around, and you ought to be focusing on the love. The Occupy movement is a love movement. It's not hating anybody. When I give a critique of oligarchy, I'm not talking about hating oligarchs. I'm talking about the use of oligarchic power, which is a choice. It is a decision. We're not demonizing anybody. We are demonizing systems. That's why none of us are purely part of the solution. We're all shot through with contradictions. There's white supremacy inside of me. There's male supremacy inside of me. There's homophobia inside of me. I've got to work it through. I've got to wrestle with it. That's where the courage to imagine and empathize plays a fundamental role. So don't let anybody tell you the Occupy movement is about hatred and revenge. There's a qualitative difference between justice and revenge. It is the beginning of a new day. The conservative era is coming to a close. Free market fundamentalism has failed. Neoliberal policies here and abroad are morally bankrupt. They have no future if you're concerned about poor and working people. And the challenge is first to shatter the sleepwalking. That's the first thing we have to do. In that sense, the Occupy movement is already victorious because it has shattered sleepwalking. Everybody's got to talk about corporate greed. I don't care who you are. You could be right-wing, centrist, neoliberal, or revolutionary. That's a beautiful thing. In America, America is a place that often is afraid of the truth when it comes to allowing suffering to speak. It's true. Look at the U.S. Constitution. No reference to the institution of slavery. 22% of the inhabitants of the 13 colonies, their very labor producing the wealth, the precondition for American democracy. No reference to that institution. And you're going to end up fighting a civil war over an institution not invoked in your Constitution. That's called chickens coming home to roost. You reap what you sow. And if it wasn't for Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, William Lloyd Garrison, and so many others, they say, you know what? Given all of this rage that's surfacing, just like in the Occupy movement, it's at a fork in the road. You can either go toward anger, revenge, bigotry, or you can go toward love, justice, and equality. That has been the fundamental role of the black prophetic tradition from Frederick Douglass to A. Philip Randolph to Ida B. Wells Barnett to Fannie Lou Hamer to Ella Baker to Martin Luther King Jr. How is it that when these black peoples who have been terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized for so long, hated for so long, keep dishing out all of this love? That's a fundamental question. And I want to come to a close on this note of hope, because it's precisely when we lift our voices and engage that we indirectly and directly empower each other. And the empowerment is not a pat on the back. It's an unsettling. It's like that first line in Henry David Thoreau's Walden. What can I do to wake my neighbors from their sleepwalking? That's what lifting your voice is all about. It's like line 24A in Plato's Apology, where Socrates says, the cause of my unpopularity was my parrhesia, my plain speech, my fearless speech, my unintimidated speech, my frank speech that had to do with that which was calling into question those assumptions and presuppositions that had blinded people for so long, generated deliberate ignorance for so long. But once that suffering began to haunt them, they needed empowerment, and they started looking for folk who've been Socratic and prophetic and tragicomic and blues-like. Thank God for the Occupy movement.
That was Cornel West, professor at the Center for African American Studies and Department of Religion at Princeton University, speaking in December 2011 at the University of California at Berkeley. You can hear a full-length version of the event, including a dialogue between Carl Dix and Cornel West, as well as questions and answers, at our website, radioproject.org. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to field producer Alton Bird. I'm Kyungjin Lee. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.